Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 18th of March. This hour of the program, a huge backlash against AIG for handing out $167 million in retention bonuses. President Barack Obama said that he'll try to block the payments and recover the money. New York State Attorney General Andrew Cuomo has issued subpoenas after AIG failed to respond to his request for the bonus details. Both say the bonuses are an outrage to taxpayers who own nearly 80% of the troubled insurance giant. 73 employees were given $1 million or more. 11 employees left the company after receiving those bonuses. And there are questions today about who knew what when, if there legally is any way to stop this, or if we need to depend on the sense of morality among the people at AIG who gave out these bonuses. And what do you do about this outrage among the American people who own a good chunk of AIG at this point in time? All of this on the table, the first hour of our program today, and our guest is joining us by phone from Zurich. Professor Edward Stewart is a professor of economics at Northeastern Illinois University. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655 for you to join our conversation, or send an email if you'd like, and that's talk at WPR.org. Professor Stewart, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Well, I'm sitting here in the sunshine in Zurich. It's a little bit warmer than I expected, and happy to be on the air with you.
Well, you're a lucky guy. Warm temperatures in Zurich. What a day you have ahead of you.
And unfortunately, I'm not one of the Zurich bankers looking for a job after the financial meltdown. So
right.
I am a little bit better situated.
Yeah. Well, what about the American people? How well situated are we with this? There's a people are mad.
Yes. People are mad, and rightfully so. I must say at the outset, I'm not an expert on compensation law, so I have kind of just a general economist view. That one of the problems that has needed to be addressed for the last 15 or 20 years in America is how you compensate top executives and how you pay for performance. And I think this AIG debacle really illustrates a really, really severe problem, is that the schemes for rewarding executives don't seem to have much connection with real performance.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and the other thing that's really kind of that's also totally out of whack is that the top pay of executives in the U.S. has gotten so large relative to average pay. I was looking at some statistics recently. In the 1950s and the 1960s, the average CEO in America got about 50 times the salary of an average worker, and last year that number was about 300. So I don't think you could make a case that we have six times much better management than we did in the 50s and 60s, but we're paying six times more.
Right.
And don't seem to be getting much for the money.
It's hard to believe, Professor Stewart, that considering the performance of this country and the fact that in large measure they got us into this horrible mess, had the audacity to give out these kinds of bonuses. Who are these people? What world are they living in?
Exactly. And the excuse they give you is that, well, we have to pay that for talent. And the answer
right.
is, I'm not sure we want that talent.
Yeah, right, exactly. We have to pay this to retain people.
We have lots of accounting and finance majors at Northeastern Illinois University who'd be happy to go to work, who are quite qualified and don't need million-dollar bonuses to do rational financial decision-making.
Right. Send them to Washington. Start some hearings, right?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. What about the legality of all of this? Now, people are saying that this was something that was a contract that there are conflicting reports here, a contract that was written in January of 2008. So there was no choice but to pay this. I'm a little confused. There was no choice but to pay compensation, but it was up to the administrators. How much would we be paid, or what's the story here?
I have really not much to add on this. It is the case that AIG is still, in technical terms, a private firm, even though the government owns 80% of the of the Capitol. But contracts are contracts. One of the things that people have been yelling about Obama is that this is socialism and so forth. But if we had real socialism, the government could simply say, no, we're not paying you, you're fired. But we don't really have socialism. This is a market-based system, and private compensation contracts are private contracts and may be rather tough to void from any kind of legal standpoint.
Mm-hmm. We gave them, I understand, we've given them a couple bailouts. The first,
right.
Are we talking about the first bailout that our money is, this was a last year thing and now there's a this year thing and there are still problems with the this year thing that we didn't put restrictions on bonuses with the latest $30 billion?
Well, the first bailouts came in October of 2008, right? That was at the beginning of the financial meltdown. Bear Stearns was taken over, Lehman Brothers was allowed to fail, and then the realization that AIG was too big and too interconnected with all of the rest of the financial system to fail. And so the Treasury Department under former Secretary of the Treasury Paulson essentially was just pouring money into AIG without much in the way of restrictions or legal constraints. So that first chunk of bailout money, there may not be any strings or constraints attached to it. So that's one of the problems that you have with trying to get this bonus money back, is that there wasn't anything put in the first bailout package that restricted bonus payments or any kind of compensation payments.
Why not? Why didn't somebody look at that?
That's a good question, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm. And in terms of the second batch of money, there's a news report today, Senator Ron Wyden saying that the furor over this could have been avoided had the Obama White House and members of Congress backed legislation that he and Senator Olympia Snowe introduced more than a month ago. He's from Oregon, a Democrat, said that during the crafting of the stimulus package, he and his Republican colleague introduced a provision that would have forced bailout recipients to cap their bonuses at $100,000, any amount above that taxed at 35%. The language made it through the Senate, but during conference committee with the House, it was, according to this report, inexplicably removed.
Yeah, that I don't know the particular details of that legislation, but you have to remember that, as you said, some of these bonus contracts were signed in January of 2008. So there is an ex post facto problem here that you can't change contracts after they've been signed.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure what kind of legislation could go back retroactively and affect those contracts and those payment programs.
Mm-hmm. Is this company going to make it?
That's a really good question. What I suspect will happen is that because it has been much, much too big to fail, one of the main economic lessons I hope people draw from this is that we can't let companies, no matter of what industry, finance, manufacturing, what have you, we just can't let companies get too big to fail. And AIG in its present form is too big to fail, so what should happen, and probably what will happen, is that it will get broken up into smaller firms and sold off piecemeal to other different kinds of insurance companies. But there probably won't be, in the next few years, there probably won't be an AIG in its present form.
Mm-hmm. And this is pretty simplistic on my part, but it rounded out for me. Is it true that it failed because they were giving shady mortgages to people and willingly gave them those, and then they just didn't get their money back? Is that how the whole thing started, because people couldn't pay it?
Well, that's part of it, but the real problem is that if it had just been shady mortgages made by your good old neighborhood savings and loan, then the problem is not so widespread. But what happens is we don't have your good old neighborhood savings and loan anymore. We have Lehman Brothers and Merrill Lynch and Bear Stearns and AIG packaging these mortgages and selling them as individual securities, and then AIG selling insurance on those bundled securities. And when the mortgages start to get a little dicey, then the packages get a little dicey, and then the insurance gets a little dicey, and all kinds of financial institutions get clobbered.
Mm-hmm. What do you think is going to, Professor Stewart, make the American people feel better about this? This is a lot of money for us. This is our thing.
It's a lot of money, and I think the only thing that's going to make everybody feel better, I'm sure, is that there's some kind of a handle gotten on what kinds of financial system we have. I said already that I think most people are going to draw the conclusion that individual financial institutions are too big. The other conclusion is that financial markets have been too complicated and too badly regulated. There's a lot of regulation of the U.S. financial market, but it's done by six or seven different agencies that either overlap or there's gaps between. And so although we have a lot of financial regulation, we don't have very smart financial regulation, and that's one of the things that's going to have to change as well. Chairman Bernanke, in his 60 Minutes interview, that was one of the things, I think one of the good points he made, is that there needs to be a more systematic and a more rational system of regulation of financial markets, and that's going to drive, I think, a simplification of financial markets, mm-hmm. so that ordinary people like you and I can understand what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's reached the point where it's hard to understand all of this.
Also the problem is that people, not only can semi-intelligent people like you and I not understand it, but the people who are actually making these transactions for AIG and Lehman Brothers, they didn't understand much of what they were doing. And that's a serious problem.
And they were making millions of dollars, and we weren't.
And they were getting millions of dollars for performance pay, yes.
Right. Yeah. What about this idea? I don't even know if this could be done, that they will be taxed on this money. Can Congress do that? Do you know?
That's kind of hard because usually tax laws aren't written for specific occupations. They're written for specific income levels. So, it sounds like one of those things. Oh, sure, let's just write a tax law that taxes the bonus on John Smith who worked for AIG, but that usually doesn't work very well.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls for Professor Stewart, and we'll take them in a moment. There's one line open. Take it if you would like right now. Professor Edward Stewart is a professor of economics at Northeastern Illinois University, and he's joining us by phone from Zurich. We're looking, of course, at the outrage over AIG for handing out $167 million in retention bonuses. What do you think? Is there a way to get that money back? Are we contractually obligated to pay that money? And what is wrong with this whole system? And was there something that the Obama administration could have done to keep these round of bonuses from taking place? 800-486-8655 is our number. If you'd like to send an email, that's talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today in this difficult economy. I know that some of you listening have lost your jobs. You've been laid off. We'll be speaking with the author of Rebound, a proven plan for starting over after job loss. All right, let's go to phone calls, starting with Daryl from Exonia. Hi, Daryl. Go right ahead.
How you doing?
All right. How are you?
My question is, because my understanding of the AIG, the biggest mess they had was they sold insurance for, like, these credit default swaps and securities for more. Hello?
Yeah, we're here. We've just lost our guest.
Oh.
We'll need to find him. All right, but go ahead.
But so my question is, like, isn't that criminal? Like, how could they sell all these contracts insuring securities that they never had the money to cover? I mean, isn't that like a guy who would say, I'm going to sell roofs to all these people on this block and take a deposit and then didn't put the roofs on? I mean, isn't that criminal? I mean, they took all this money and said, we're going to sell insurance. And then when the thing started to go bad, they said, well, we don't have the money to cover it because we never thought we'd have to. Well, that's criminal. Shouldn't these guys all be in jail instead of giving them bonuses?
Okay. I'm going to ask you to hold just a second and ask that again to our guest as soon as we find him. What do you think should be done here?
Well, they say, on the news this morning on Good Morning America, they said, well, we've been told, that this memo, that they're too big to fail. You know, that's propaganda they're putting out. Well, yeah, we can't fail. But I also think it has to do with America's credibility in the financial system, because all these other countries sent their money to America, trusting us to invest it for them, and we pittered it away, And now they're afraid of the consequences because now all these countries are going to keep their money at home. And if they do that, like China's saying, we're worried about our trillion-dollar investment we got over here in America. If they pulled that money out, we would be crushed. So America has to put on a happy face and say, oh, no, everything's fine. We got your money. It's all safe. We got it here. But what can be done? I mean, the damage is done now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you don't feel as though there's any way for you to get some of your money back here?
Oh, it's done. You know, that, I mean, the government has to share some responsibility because they're supposed to be watching these people, but they're all, it's basically the damage is done. And, you know.
Right. It's a lot of money, isn't it? It's just one heck of a lot of money.
It's monopoly money.
Yeah. Yeah.
Beanie Babies. They suddenly realize that all the Beanie Babies are really not worth $500. They're a bag of beans. They're worth 25 cents. Unfortunately, we have $5 trillion worth of them.
Uh-huh. All right, we're going to get our guest back on the air and give you a chance to ask him whether or not what's happened here is legal. Professor Stewart, we were talking with a listener here who was wondering about whether or not there's illegality here. Go ahead and ask the question to our guest, Daryl.
Okay, my question is, I mean, not that they got into this trouble by selling insurance on all these securities and credit default swaps and things, and that when these things went bad, they didn't have the money right to cover the insurance bets that they made. Is that not criminal? Can you not say, I mean, isn't that like selling somebody something that you really don't have? So aren't you, shouldn't these people like be arrested and say you falsely guaranteed all these things that you have no money to guarantee?
Well, it's not exactly like that. It's more like if you and I went into the insurance business of insuring 16-year-old boy teenage drivers and we made them pay $1 a month and then agreed to fund all of their car damages and hope that we had enough policyholders and not enough accidents. So it's not really illegality. It's more stupidity and incompetence. And unfortunately, you can't put people in jail for that.
Hmm. Okay.
Thanks, Daryl, very much for your call.
Yep.
Let's go next to Mike from South Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Hello. Good morning. I understand all this. It's not complicated, and I understand it. First, to answer your last caller's question, it is legal because Larry Summers, when he had power in the government with Clinton, pushed to make this kind of thing legal. They were allowed to offer insurance, credit default swaps, but not call them insurance. Therefore, they did not have to keep reserves because it was not regulated as insurance. Okay, I'm upset about these bonuses given to AIG. But I think we're losing sight of the bigger picture. AIG funneled over $8 billion, not million, billion dollars to Goldman Sachs, okay? And when the decision was made to bail out AIG in the fall of 2008, members of the Federal Reserve of New York met. They met on a weekend, and only one non-member of the board was present. One member from Wall Street, and that was Lloyd Blankfein, the president of Goldman Sachs. What was Lloyd Blankfein doing at that meeting? Well, he was at that meeting because in order to bail out AIG, I mean, with AIG's bailout, Goldman Sachs essentially was bailed out. And, you know, we're talking about $160 million being awarded in bonuses to AIG executives. Why aren't we talking about the $8 billion that was funneled to AIG? Merrill Lynch also got significant amounts of money, $1 billion. Basically, my contention is the Goldman Sachs Mafia alumni, friends of Goldman Sachs, are running the financial institutions of this country and running the Treasury. That's the crime. And it's simple to understand what's going on. This is not complicated stuff. It's very simple, and I'll stay on the line if you want.
All right, Mike. Professor Stewart.
Yeah, I tend to not believe too much in conspiracy theories because it requires too much intelligence on the part of the actors. I think the point, Kathleen, you and I were discussing earlier is that one of the big problems with the AIG situation is that AIG. Is not only an insurer of Goldman Sachs, and it's an insurer of almost every important financial institution, not just in the United States, but around the world. So, yes, bailing out AIG bails out a lot of other financial institutions, and that's why it was done. That's why AIG was too big to fail, is because if it failed, then lots of other financial institutions failed. And the thinking is that if those financial institutions fail, then businesses who depend on them for credit and simple payment systems would fail as well. So, yes, unfortunately, by bailing out AIG and Goldman Sachs and Lehman Brothers, we, to some extent, reward people for their failure. But given the nature of the financial system and the market system that we live in, it's pretty much the lesser of many evils.
Mm-hmm. What about his point that the people who are now in charge of economic policy in this country, namely Summers and Geithner, were involved in helping to further the excesses and the mess of what we've been living with AIG and other corporations that we've had to bail out? Is that true?
It's true in the sense that there's a lot of blame to go around, starting with the deregulation in the early 80s of the savings and loan system and the real estate savings and loan crash in the mid 80s, and then the further deregulation under the first Bush and the Clinton administration, and the kind of lax powers taken away from the SEC, and the belief on the part of the Federal Reserve throughout the 90s and the early 2000s that financial markets were smart enough to accurately assess risk. There's a lot of blame to go around, and there aren't many individual heroes or institutional heroes who saw what was coming and said something.
Right.
There were a few, but they were pretty much ignored.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Mike, for the call. Here's an email. Corporations choose bankruptcy protection in large part so they can void contracts to their workforce and suppliers. Can't the federal government declare AIG bankrupt and void these bonus contracts?
Yeah, that would be that's probably the only that's a very intelligent kind of point, because that's about the only way in which that happens. When I was discussing this in class actually on Monday with some of my students, that the only way you can negotiate to void contracts or payments is to actually declare bankruptcy and have the probate judge or the bankruptcy judge start making decisions. And that may be an option farther on down the line, but right now I think maybe the thinking in Washington is that the financial system is so tender and so weak and shaky that a declaration of bankruptcy by AIG would be just too harsh of a medicine right now. The patient is too sick to take that kind of cure.
Chuck from Green Bay, hi.
Good morning. How are you today?
Fine. How are you?
Bad.
Good.
I have more of a statement than anything. Wasn't the writing on the wall about these golden parachutes or bonuses last year? I know that it had to have been because they tried to make it so there was no bonuses when they gave them the money initially, and the original offer was rejected and sent back and rewritten. I don't understand why people are so crazy about this. We knew that this money was going to be given to these heads for bonuses, correct?
I don't know when we knew.
And there was a reluctance on the part of people in the federal government and Congress to dictate salaries for a private company. That we're running up against this argument that I'm sure you've discussed, Kathleen, of do we have socialism or capitalism?
Right.
And the more the government gets into saying, okay, you can only pay these people so much and you can't pay these people this much, that gets into this philosophical argument of how much do we want the government intervening in the economy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there is precedent, because in the 1930s, in the Roosevelt administration, the Reconstruction Finance Corporation went in, when it took over, it nationalized banks and it established a cap on compensation. So there is precedence, and there are people who are arguing for that. But then you run up against the counter argument that, no, this is too much government, this is socialism, and this is the death of the free market system, and we have to protect it.
I wonder if anybody will be keeping track of those 73 employees, if we know exactly who they are, who made $1 million or more, and see whether they'll give it back to the government.
Yeah.
I can't imagine.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I'm not sure about that. Yeah, well, and the other thing is, where would they, would somebody else hire them?
Right. You might, huh? Maybe you would.
No, I'm just a poor professor paid for by the state of Illinois that doesn't have much money, so I'm not really sure I can. I'm hiring TurboTax is doing my financial advisor. So,
thanks, Chuck, for the call. Let's go to Andrew from Ashland. Hi, Andrew.
Hi. I think the debate over whether these executives are being paid too much is missing the point. Because I think the outrage needs to, the question needs to be whether the government should have bailed out AIG to begin with. And I think this whole notion that they're too big to fail is absurd. Because it implies that the government can rescue the financial system, but all we're really doing is passing on the insolvency of the banking system onto the government. And 2-3 years ago, no one would have been talking about the possibility of AIG collapsing. Right now, no one's talking about the possibility of the U.S. government collapsing, but that's exactly where we're headed. Now, granted, it might come in the form of hyperinflation or something like that, but China knows it. The rest of the world knows it. It's just really we're buying our time. That's all we're doing.
Professor Stewart.
Well, I'm not going to be that apocalyptic. I'm a little more optimistic because we've gone through these things before. I mentioned already the Reconstruction Finance Corporation and the New Deal did essentially what he's talking about. The government stepped in and bailed out the financial system. The Resolution Trust Corporation in the middle of the 1980s stepped in and bailed out the savings and loan industry. And it was necessary to do that. It didn't mean the end of the economy. It certainly didn't mean the end of private financial markets. And it's fairly regularly that governments have to step in and bail out private enterprises and sometimes entire parts of the system, especially the financial system. In many other countries, the government in some ways is the financial system. In many European countries, most of the large banks have had for a very, very long time significant government ownership and direction. We have the most privately directed financial system in the world. That has a lot of benefits, but it also has a lot of risks, and we're paying for the risks now.
Thanks, Andrew, for your call. Pat is next from Milwaukee. Hello, Pat.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
It just popped in my head just before I got accepted on the radio. The idea of our government not acting on this, you know, it is a distraction, and it shouldn't be, so it should be acted on quickly. They should have the cojones to do it, take the 1/860th of a million back. Our government takes homes, you know, if a highway has to go for public use, for the good of the people. If this isn't for the good of the spirit of the people, and a real $160 million of cash, why we can't break these contracts of men and women that didn't uphold any of their contracts in the numbers of trillions, I can't believe our government can do anything then. Well, you know, it would be a dream that they would do anything bigger than a $160 million problem.
Professor Stewart.
I think he's just given a very, very interesting set of case discussion to law schools and whether you can apply the principle of eminent domain, which is what he's talking about, to the financial sector. That's maybe that's going to be the new legal precedent, and you developed it on your show. But so far, eminent domain only exists, I think, with regard to real property. But that's a very ingenious idea that you just simply expand it to financial assets as well.
Mm-hmm.
But you'd have to ask the people at the Wisconsin Law School about that.
Well, let's do it and see what happens. I mean, this is our government against 73 people that didn't do anything.
You have an interesting point and an interesting analogy that it is a kind of public domain issue that they're costing the taxpayers and the entire society. But I'm not a lawyer, and I wouldn't want to judge the legality of applying eminent domain in a new area of law.
Thank you very much for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our guest this hour is Professor Edward Stewart, professor of economics at Northeastern Illinois University. And we're talking about outrage all over the place at AIG for handing out $165 million in retention bonuses. Or are they performance bonuses, or what exactly are they? And that's the area of our next caller's question, Jerry from Lake Mills. Hi, Jerry.
Good morning.
Hi.
I heard on the radio that this retention bonus was meant to keep the people in position till the end of 2009 when they were going to be laid off. And if they left before the end of 2009 doing their normal job, they wouldn't get the bonus. I don't think it's a bonus that's meant for performance or because of the people who made the bad business decisions are getting it. It's the people who were kept, retained, to run the business. What do you think of that?
Yeah, Kathleen, I think some of the bonuses are performance and some of them are retention.
Mm.
The retention bonuses are what I alluded to kind of at the beginning of our conversation, that this is the argument is given that we need to pay these retention bonuses to keep this top talent at our firm. And my question and a lot of other economists' question is this talent that you actually want to pay for and do you want to keep? The problem is, obviously, if you're somebody who's been promised $1 million or two or $3 million, that if you stay on the job until the end of 2009, and we're in the midst of an economy where the financial sector is shedding jobs by the hundreds of thousands,
mm-hmm.
You don't have much incentive to leave. To quit, and you have 1 or 2 million reasons at least to stay until the end of 2009. So, unless you're going to tell those people that they're fired, which in which case I think they get the bonus anyway. It's only if they voluntarily leave that they don't get the bonus, and that's one of the real problems with this whole legal structure and what the government can and can't do with regard to rescinding the bonuses or the retention premiums, whatever you want to call those.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call. And 11, I don't know what their circumstances were. The news last night was saying 11 people have left after receiving their bonuses. I don't know when
yeah.
they did this or if they were fired or what happened.
No, they probably had I suspect, Kathleen, that all of these bonuses, each of these contracts is different, right? What they're getting paid for and what the triggers are for the bonuses are different. Usually these kinds of contracts are negotiated individually because these people are considered the, you know, stars in the financials. It's just like the Milwaukee Brewers or the Chicago Cubs paying baseball players. Every individual baseball player, every player has a different contract with different performance bonuses and retention bonuses.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can't say that, well, the Brewers pay this kind of bonus or the Cubs pay this kind of bonus. But I don't want to talk about the Cubs very much because my heart is still broken.
Well, let's talk about the Yankees then because they have all the money.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. Let's go next to John from Milwaukee. Hello, John.
Hi. I was going to ask Professor Stewart, earlier in the show, you were discussing the ratio of the executives to the workers, and you said that earlier in the century or last century, it was around 50 to 1, and now it's around 300 to 1. I seem
right.
to remember when Chrysler merged with Mercedes or Daimler, there was a problem with what the executives were earning.
Yeah, I know what you're getting at. The Daimler executives made a much smaller ratio than the Chrysler executives.
And that's the basis of my question. What I was going to ask is, what do they do? And it seems to me like what's going on is executives have the ability to stack the board of directors to allow their salaries to be inflated. And I'm curious
and
as
one
to
of,
what
and one
they
of the
do
things
in Europe
your,
to prevent
your
that.
Question, I'm sure, is that Chryslers aren't that much better than Mercedes. So why are those executives getting so much more, right?
Right. Well, I'm curious as to what Europe does to prevent the stacking of the board of directors.
Well, one of the things they do is something I mentioned earlier, is that Mercedes, most large, especially German companies and French, Austrian companies, the governments, through the banking system, own a large block of the shares. So there is a kind of a government control or understanding. And there's also government-wide wage and compensation negotiations. So the government is part of the compensation discussions, not with just the executives, but with the workers. The unions are, and the employers' associations. So there's a much more kind of explicit and transparent agreement as to who gets what. And the caller is right. I'm sorry, I forgot his name. But one of the problems with the American compensation schemes for top executives is that it's top executives themselves who are setting up most of these schemes. And as you would expect, Kathleen, if you and I had pretty much unlimited ability to set our compensation schemes, I'm sure we'd be paying ourselves a lot more than we are.
Right, but not millions, right?
Oh, I'm sure. Well, you might be worth millions. I'd only be worth several hundred thousand more.
Thanks, John, very much for your call. Here's an email. It's hard to believe that nothing can be done about these bonus contracts when frequently unions are asked to restructure contracts to help ailing companies.
Yeah. But that goes back to the point that these are individual contracts with individual people, and they're not company-wide kinds of contracts.
Yeah. Bill from Orfordville is next. Hi, Bill.
Good morning.
Hi.
Very, very disturbing program in many respects, but I believe that there's enough anger out there among the population that if Mr. President Obama does not solve this specific incident kind of thing, I think he's a one-term president. People, you can talk law, you can talk propaganda, you can talk economic system. You know, the people would be willing to change this system. They are, I think the grassroots, the folks that you talk to at the supermarket and on the street, they've had enough of this stuff. And unless there's justice here, there's trouble coming.
And what's justice for you? What do you want to have happen?
Well, those bonuses ought to be taken back. There ought to be some people thrown in the slammer. You talk about a country of laws and the rest of that stuff, but there's also some vigilantes out there, too. You know, I'm telling you, people are angry.
Professor Stewart.
I hear the anger all over the place, even students who are kind of just coming into the understanding of what's going on in the world. And the question, I go back again and again, the question is, yes, I mean, there is clearly injustice and unfairness and something completely out of whack with the incentive system systems, but this got started, not to defend President Obama, but this got started before he arrived on the scene. The original AIG bailout came from, as one of your previous callers termed it, the Goldman Sachs Mafia, Hank Paulson. If there's going to be change, it's going to have to be much broader than just putting one politician out of office.
Mm. More phone calls in a moment. Professor Edward Stewart, professor of economics at Northeastern Illinois University, our guest. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, the author of Rebound, A Proven Plan for Starting Over After Job Loss. Okay, Bill, thanks for the call, and let us go to Steve from Monona. Hi, Steve. Hello, Steve. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm on the Beltline. But so good morning.
Good morning.
I guess I really have just two questions for the for your guest, and they're both related to AIG being defined as being too big to sale. A couple of days ago, I was listening to a program, and somebody asked the same question. If they're too big to fail, does it mean they're just too big? And if that's the case, should part of this deal be that they be divided into separate companies so that no company, no single entity is defined as too big?
Hmm.
And then a follow-up to that is, in the future, when other financial companies want to merge and consolidate, will the government take into consideration what's happening now, and will the future entity become one that's too big to fail?
Professor Stewart.
Yeah, I think he's hit on all some important points that you and I have already kind of been talking about. Yes, it is too big to fail, and the problem is it shouldn't have been allowed to be that big. I think he's also on point with future consolidation in not just the financial industry but other industries as well. That the antitrust laws and the competition laws are going to have to be much more strictly enforced, and the idea
Hello. I think we lost our guest for just a moment, so we'll try and get him again. He's in Zurich and sounds pretty clear, doesn't he? But I think that we just lost the. I don't know if he's on a cell phone or what. So we'll continue with his thought in a moment after we find him once again. The second hour of our program, we have kind of an economic show going on. It's not all happy news, is it? But there are a lot of people who are losing jobs, who are being laid off. The numbers are astronomically high. And we figured that some of you may be in that, unfortunately, situation yourselves. So we have the author of a very helpful book, Rebound, A Proven Plan for Starting Over After Job Loss. The author began this whole area of study when her father was laid off after 25 years with the CIA. So you know, it's hard to what did you do in your last job? You can't even talk about what you did in your last job because you worked for the CIA. So she is with us in a moment. We left you in mid-sentence, Professor Stewart.
I think there was a chocolate satellite here in Switzerland that got in the way of the T-Mobile communication. Sorry about that.
That's all right.
I'm just going to finish up with the last caller. I think that's one of the clear messages or clear lessons from this whole financial debacle, is that the financial system, the individual institutions are much too large and should be broken up and should not be allowed to merge and consolidate and expand market share beyond some maximum size, and that as part of the whole new architecture of financial regulation, there's going to be, I think, an insistence on a much more competitive financial system with smaller firms relative to the market size. That this idea that AIG is too big to fail, I think, is points in at least one direction for solutions.
Tom from Fond du Lac. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Yeah, what I don't understand is why there's not more outrage against the rating companies that rated these bonds, Moody's, Standard & Poor's. I mean, they were complicit in this whole thing, and without their help, it could not have happened.
That's exactly right. So that gets back. I was making a point to one of the previous callers who was picking on these 73 people at AIG as the main villains. There are lots of villains in this melodrama, and the rating agencies, all of the rating agencies, bear a big role. And again, I don't think it's anything that they did that was intentionally criminal. I think they didn't understand what they were doing, and they were in uncharted territory with not the adequate kinds of safeguards and regulation or information. So the caller's absolutely right about the rating agencies. They dropped the ball big time and bear some significant share of the blame.
Yeah, we don't hear very much about them, though, do we?
No, but that's one of the things that kind of let this go on for a while, is that when Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns and Merrill Lynch and Citigroup and all of these other financial wizards were packaging and securitizing and insuring these
hybrid securities, the rating agencies were giving them AAA, low-risk kinds of ratings. And so people that were buying them under not false or, misleading, but not, probably not criminally misleading, but under less than perfect knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for your call. Susan is next from Coon Valley. Hi, Susan.
Good morning.
Hello.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
We sure can.
Okay. You know, there's a lot of people that are very, very angry about this. And as your guest just talked about, that there are hundreds of people involved in this scam. Some knew what they were doing, some did not. But I find it very hard to believe that to the degree of money that's involved in this, that there were not people that knew what was going on. And in the end, some of those folks ended up getting these humongous bonuses. Now, I would much rather put my tax dollars into a high-handed investigation of this, of these bonuses, of these folks, and I don't understand why that cannot happen. People talk about it. The American people are angry about it. Why can't it happen?
Professor Stewart.
I think actually there is some political stirring for some for a temporary congressional or joint congressional executive branch special investigating committee that does take a comprehensive look at the causes and the heroes and villains, if you will. There were a few people who kind of understood what was going on in the regulatory sense. There was a member of the Board of Governors, the late Ed Gramlich, professor of economics, who was warning Alan Greenspan back in 2001, 2002, that the mortgage market was out of control and that these assets were much riskier than were commonly believed. And Greenspan's position was, no, these financial professionals know what they are doing. They have sophisticated risk analysis models, and so we don't need any regulation, and the private market that accurately judges risks and returns will handle the problem.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, there were some people, a few people who kind of understood, but there weren't, and there were people, and obviously in the financial sector, who knew that this was probably not going to last and that they were going to try to make as much money as they could very, very quickly, but that's kind of American as apple pie as well.
Right. Susan, thanks very much for the call. Josh from Manitowoc, hi.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a real quick comment, and I think we bailed these companies out, or AIG out, $170 billion, and they paid out $170 million. So we're only talking about 1% of this bailout. Not saying that I agree with what AIG did or anything, but I just think it's kind of a smokescreen as the government's trying to pass a multi-trillion dollar budget with all sorts of other additives, kind of get the American people focused away from what our government, who's spending lots more money, what they're actually doing with our money, as opposed to, you know, 1% of how we bailed out AIG. And I'll take my comments.
All right, so 1% really isn't that big a deal, Professor Stewart? Compared to our
budget.
It's not
a big a deal in the greater scheme of things. And as the caller points out, the stimulus package is close to $800 billion. So
mm-hmm.
Yes, it's not large in terms of its effect on the overall economy. But I think the anger is real, and I think the anger is justified, because it is a symbol of something, that these are the people who created the problem, who created the need for the $800 billion stimulus package, and the
right.
$600 or $700 billion deficit that we're going to have to run this year, necessarily. So I fully support the stimulus package and the budget to get the economy out of the unemployment mess that we're in. But I do have some understanding of why this relatively small amount. It's kind of strange to talk about $180 million.
I know.
Small, but in the scheme of things, it is relatively small. In terms of numbers, but I think in terms of symbolism,
right.
And in terms of the way the system is set up, I think it's a very, very important number and something that deserves a lot of attention and attempts to restructure and to reform the financial system and the regulatory bodies that regulate it.
Yeah, we have about 30 seconds left, but I think you'll have time for your point. Greg from Watertown.
Thanks, Kathleen. I think the root of the problem is ethical in nature. Neoclassical capitalism has stripped out of the system any type of honesty or fairness or responsibility to your assets and people you're representing and response or respect for future generations and a complete lack of compassion for those that don't have it. And classical capitalism, as envisioned by Adam Smith, was based on ethical standards. And our system today has stripped out any type of moral constraint that may have been there. And we need to correct that problem if we're going to correct the situation.
Thank you, Greg, very much for the call. Professor Stewart, thanks for your time. Have a great rest of the day in Zurich, sir.
Thank you, Kathleen. Enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you. We enjoyed the hour as well, as much as you can enjoy this kind of topic. Professor Edward Stewart, professor of economics at Northeastern Illinois University. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, and thanks to Rob Schroeder for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We'll have news coming up from National Public Radio and return with another hour of Wednesday morning conversation, so please stay with us. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.